KaiserNetwork.org.
It's Tuesday morning, the third day of our conference. I'm Tim Mastro from the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention at CDC and have the pleasure of serving as a co-chair of this year's meeting. And welcome to this plenary session on new innovations in HIV prevention. Among the many messages we've heard loudly and clearly during this conference is the need for more effective HIV prevention strategies to add to our toolbox. In the past year, we've learned of disappointing outcomes of major clinical trials of an HIV vaccine and a topical microbicide gel, reminding us again how difficult it is to develop a safe and effective HIV vaccine and a topical microbicide for vaginal and anal use. While we continue to pursue these critical prevention tools, we must make better use of our currently available methods and continue to explore new avenues. This morning, we will hear about new developments in four important areas: the internet, male circumcision, the use of antiretrovirals, and HIV testing. We are fortunate to have with us today four outstanding speakers who will provide us with state-of-the-art lectures on these subjects. Our first presenter will be Dr. Sheena Bull on the internet and HIV transmission. Sheena Bull is an associate professor at the University of Colorado Denver Health Sciences Center. Dr. Bull has worked for the past 10 years on the development and testing of technology-based interventions for HIV, STD, and chronic disease prevention. Her work has included a focus on MSM, youth, and Latinos. Currently, Dr. Bull is principal investigator on two NIH-funded trials to use social networking sites and mobile phones in HIV preventions. Dr. Sheena Bull.
Good morning. I've actually changed this talk from internet and HIV to technology and HIV because the original title is actually obsolete. I'm hoping that the IT information technology field moves so rapidly, but I'm hoping that the information I'm providing you today won't be obsolete by the time I'm done. My objectives today are to offer a retrospective on the use of the internet for HIV prevention. And I would like to put a caveat here. The HIV behavioral surveillance has been done very effectively online, but I don't have a lot of time in this presentation, so I'm going to focus exclusively on interventions. I want to consider achievements in the field to date and opportunities for where we're going to go in the future. So I'm going to give you a little bit of context for my talk. The social ecological framework is a useful tool to consider interventions in context. I'm going to set you up with my primary point here. My premise is that we cannot hope to achieve significant declines in HIV incidence and prevalence using the internet and other technologies if we don't intervene beyond the individual. We need to focus on interventions for care providers, for organizations and communities in order to move forward. I'll give you an example of smoking for one, which has been very effective in reining in interventions at all of these different levels. So I'll bring you back a little bit. Some of you may not be familiar with our earlier work. Smart Sex Quest was a site developed for men who have sex with men in response to one of the things that we often find ourselves a position in. People are using technology in innovative and creative ways, and they're frequently far ahead of researchers. And in this case, men were using technology to solicit sex partners, and we developed the Smart Sex Quest in response. We were excited about the trial in that we were able to utilize the internet in innovative ways to tailor information and make it personally relevant for men so they could complete a risk assessment and get information tailored to their own personal risk behavior, feeling like that's a little bit more innovative using the technology than just giving text-based information that's static. However, with Smart Sex Quest, one of our major lessons was with regard to methodology. we need to have better contact information in order to effectively follow up with people. We had a huge attrition rate in this study and weren't able to determine efficacy because of that. So that led us to improve our methodologies for recruitment and follow-up. However, it introduced what I feel is a continuing balancing act for us. If we're going to determine efficacy, we also need to keep an eye on effectiveness and moving into translation. And doing things like requiring a lot of detailed personal information, a lot of registration, limits our generalizability and our reach, which is arguably one of the most important features of the internet, being able to reach all the people who are out there. So following Smart Sex Quest, we improved our methodologies and developed an internet-based intervention for youth, young adults between the ages of 18 and 24. And in this, we developed role model stories based on the AIDS community demonstration projects, trying to influence attitudes, norms, and self-efficacy for condom use. I'll give you an example of the YouthNet program. This is a little vignette that would be directed towards African-American females.
Hey, I'm Michelle. Here's the thing. I was having sex, sometimes with more than one person, sometimes with just one, but I was never absolutely sure my partner was only with me. I was gambling, taking too many risks. A couple of times I thought I had something, an infection. It was enough to get me thinking that condoms would be worth it. I felt safer if I used condoms. I thought my partner would be mad, but, well, I figured out some ways to play with them, make the sex better. Here's the thing. Guys like it if their partner puts the condom on them. Well, it makes the sex more interesting, you know? It also makes me feel more in control.
So we used community activists for this program. They volunteered to be our role models. And they participated, as well as youth, with the development of the content. And we made it an interactive program. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on our outcomes, but I will share with you. In this slide shows a model for a structural equation analysis that we conducted. And on the right, you see difference in proportion of protected acts. We were looking at condom use as our main outcome. And you see the shaded portion underneath the condom norms arrow there. Excuse me. That represents things like positive and negative outcome expectancies, self-efficacy, things that typically have been shown in a lot of other research to have an effect on condom use. However, in this sample of 18 to 24-year-olds on the internet, it had no effect. What did have an effect was condom norms. And our intervention significantly impacted condom norms through the variable of the expectation that your partner would be happy with condom norms. So we were encouraged by that. It shows us a little bit more movement in efficacy and understanding about how the internet can impact norms and potentially behavior. Methodologically, we're happy with how we can move forward in our trials. However, I have the question here, is the juice worth the squeeze? The model I just showed you really only explains about 3% of the variance in condom use. It's a very, very small effect. So one thing we could consider is, well, can we use the internet more effectively to shape norms? Certainly that's a possibility. What about the idea of thinking about the internet as having potentially greater impact, because you could have a small effect but reach a lot of people and therefore have a greater public health impact? That's certainly possible, but with a 3% variance, it's very, very small effect. The other consideration is, you say, well, we can reach more people on the internet, but are we really reaching the people at highest risk? I didn't show these data here, but on YouthNet, we did a better job compared to our earlier work and compared to work of others in recruiting people of color and a more diverse sample. However, we have a long way to go. We're still not reaching those communities as well as we can. What about increasing intensity and exposure? YouthNet was a one-time 20-minute intervention, so perhaps we should do more. My colleague in Wyoming, Dr. Ann Bowen, has published results from the Wyoming Rural AIDS Prevention Project, which is an internet-based program for men who have sex with men. and did show greater effects. Hers was a two-time intervention, so that's very encouraging. We can do better, but she is also seeing that once the incentive and study structure have been removed, people are no longer visiting the site. So that brings up the question about how to move from efficacy to effectiveness. How can we get people to continue to see our interventions and get the kind of exposure that they need to show greater effect? So some of you may have been at some of the very interesting talks we had yesterday. I don't have time to go into all of the kinds of work and innovations that are going on throughout the country, but people are using video online. They're using blogs to influence and create community. And I'll let you figure out what blogs are. I'm not going to go into detail, except it's kind of like an online diary. Using SIMS. So SIMS is a short for simulation, and it's modeled after one of the most popular video games that's out there that allows you to kind of identify a character and have them go through different situations, and you can figure out what the consequences are based on what they choose. Cartoons or other kinds of things that people are using. I'm working with Dr. Michelle Ibarra, who is PI on a recently funded study by the National Institute of Mental Health to develop and test a multi-module online intervention for Ugandan youth. So now we're moving into the African context. Cyber Senga builds on the cultural norm of using the Senga, or the ant, to help people understand about healthy sexuality. And so we're going to use, this is a picture of a billboard that's shown in many places throughout rural Uganda. And internet use is growing there in popularity as well as here, although people tend to use internet in cafes rather than in their homes. So that's another innovation that's happening. So yesterday people may also have been to sessions where they talked about using the internet to do HIV prevention outreach in chat rooms. This is an example of a chat room. For those of you who might not be familiar, the blue covers up some of the potential identifiers for folks. On the right is information about who's in the room. The big box is what chat is actually occurring. And the small box is used to communicate between individuals in the room. It's an instant message box. And lots of people are doing very innovative kinds of outreach in chat rooms, and things like forums where they can post questions and get responses, and an ask the expert type of innovation. So this increases access to information and care potentially. It's easy to establish a presence online, and aid service organizations have been particularly good at this. And there is evidence that people will join chats and participate. However, these types of interventions, chat rooms and ask the expert and forums, have not been well evaluated. We don't have rigorous evaluation for these interventions. This represents a major challenge for us. If we wait to design, conduct, and evaluate technology-based interventions, they very well may be obsolete by the time we determine their efficacy. Certainly, they're going to be out of date. 5 years is ages on the internet. CBOs arguably are more facile with quickly determining what is popular and how to parlay that into prevention and making it effective. It turns the effectiveness-efficacy equation on its head. Do programs work? Well, if we don't improve the speed with which we can do evaluation, researchers might just be placed in a position of asking more esoteric and arcane questions about technology and HIV prevention. So I'll go back to our social ecological framework and challenge us a little bit. Our own work, as well as the work in the field today, has largely been focused up here in the individual level. We're not taking advantage of all of these other opportunities to work at other levels and to link our work to have greater impact on HIV. I'm going to discuss now several innovations that are particularly exciting that do go beyond the individual. First, this is an example of banner ads that are used online. This is from a colleague in San Francisco, Deb Levine, out of the Internet Sexuality Information Services, or ISIS. These are placed in chat room and other sex solicitation environments, and people could click on one of these ads, and in this case, get information about syphilis. So the innovation here is that these ads are in the environment where risk behavior is occurring. So people are not required to leave where they're interested to go to somewhere else online. Another innovation also from ISIS, the InSpot Partner Notification Program, is an opportunity to improve reach of partner notification. People can send an email message to partners, letting them know that they potentially have been exposed. This is becoming more and more popular with health departments, particularly those with limited resources and in rural areas. The Positive Web is a project funded by the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, and the emphasis here is developing community and social support. We haven't looked at all at the efficacy of social support online and how it can promote healthy behaviors. So the idea here is people who are positive, we're starting with a pilot at the Denver Public Health Department. People who are positive can sign up and get access to testimonials of people who are living with HIV, post questions on forums, ask the expert, things like that, and be part of a community, and we're going to see how that works to affect adherence and disclosure behaviors. I Want the Kit allows people to access STD test kits via the internet and self-collect swabs and send them in for lab testing. This project is still undergoing evaluation, but it shows a great deal of promise. STDpreventiononline.org, for those of you who may not have been at a roundtable discussion last night and who are interested, if you're a provider, you can sign up for this. Just go to STD Prevention Online and sign up. It's developed as a clearinghouse for providers, and the idea here is to allow for a forum for all of us to get together and share ideas in a much more real time. It takes a lot of time for our information to get out in journals, and a colleague said sometimes it's easier to get a grant than it is to get published these days. So a lot of our information isn't getting out to each other, and this is intended for us to do just that. In the interest of time, I'm actually going to skip this one. So what we have so far, we do have a number of individual level interventions, and we can continue to develop them, and there are a number of great ones that are in progress. InSpot and the Positive Web work more in the domain of relationships. STD Center of Excellence and I Want the Kit are in organizations. I didn't describe Manhunt, but it is a partnership between internet service providers and prevention advocates. We need to do more work with organizations. Yesterday in the plenary, Dr. Fullilove talked about his work with incarcerated populations, and we haven't even begun to consider how we could use technology as people are becoming incarcerated or leaving the incarcerated environment. Policy, we need to move more and consider how we can use technology for policy. If you think about how effective organizations such as MoveOn.org are. Family and friends, could we use the internet to train parents to talk more effectively about sexuality with their kids? And I'll focus here on community to talk a little bit, just briefly as we close, on how we can use community and build community online. So I'm not going to ask anyone to admit if they've never heard of social networking or MySpace. I won't out you. But MySpace is a social networking site, and here's an example of a MySpace page. And this part right here is a section that people frequently use to post pictures of who they call their friends. And they usually post their top five or their favorite friends. And here this person posted 12. But you could click on any one of these folks and get linked to their MySpace pages. And so what we're doing, we're going to be funded by the National Institute of Nursing Research to do a social networking intervention. And in preparation of this proposal, what we did was we went to publicly available information and searched randomly in the Baltimore area for using the Baltimore zip code for a MySpace user. We came up with an 18-year-old African-American female, identified her top five friends, each of their top five friends, and we went out five different waves and were able to identify how they were connected with each other. And this is a graphical representation of the social network. So this is 500 or so people that are involved and how they're connected with each other. And you can see this kind of dense ball in the middle right side is the strongest cluster. And so with this trial, we're going to hopefully be able to identify discrete social networks and intervene at the level of the network and give lots of opportunity for people to develop their own content using blogs and contests and testimonials and things like that. It'll be very interesting to see what people come up with. And then finally, in response to our chronic problem of not effectively reaching the highest risk communities, we're going to move to a pilot study funded by NIMH to look at mobile phones and text messaging. So a lot of people may have access to the internet. We keep seeing information that the digital divide is shrinking, but people don't necessarily use it. And they certainly, some populations certainly use cell phones. African American youth are among the fastest growing consumers of mobile phones. So we're hoping to develop and test an intervention where we send frequent text messages that are theoretically based to a sample of 16 to 20-year-old black men in Philadelphia. Our colleagues in San Francisco, again, ISIS, working with the San Francisco Department of Public Health, has developed a cell phone-based intervention as well. Sex info and information about it are going to be published soon in the American Journal of Public Health. But it did show some success in reaching people and getting them good information about STD. And they can text in and ask for specific information on a specific topic, like what do I do if the condom broke, for example. So in conclusion, we know that innovations abound. Our colleagues have done some really creative work, but we have some challenges now. So I'm going to encourage people to think about reaching people where they are. We can no longer develop sites and expect people are going to come to us. We need to go to them. We also need to improve our evaluation rigor. Our research needs to improve in terms of time and accessibility. So we need to partner with those community-based organizations and help them do effective evaluations. And then finally, I'll advocate for combining our interventions, going beyond the individual to affect communities, families, and policy. Thank you for your time.
Sheena, thank you very much for that. Now I understand why my teenage daughter won't let me look at her MySpace page. From a very newly developing and modern technology, we're going to go to a technology that's been around with us for about 3,000 years. Our next presenter is Dr. Peter Kilmarks, who will present on male circumcision and HIV prevention. Peter Kilmarks is chief of the epidemiology branch in the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention at CDC. Dr. Kilmarks has extensive experience in U.S. domestic and international HIV and STD prevention and care research and programs. Peter worked in Thailand from 1996 to 2002 as chief of the Sexual Transmission Prevention Research Program at CDC's collaborative project with the Thai Ministry of Public Health, and he went on to serve as director of the CDC Botswana project in Southern Africa from 2002 to 2005. Peter trained in internal medicine and infectious diseases at Johns Hopkins University and came to CDC in 1994 as an epidemic intelligence service officer in the STD division. Peter, take it away.
Thank you, Tim. And I'd really like to thank the organizers for this opportunity to discuss male circumcision. It's an important, proven new HIV prevention intervention and to discuss its potential role in the United States. Male circumcision is the surgical removal of the foreskin from the penis. Tom Coates introduced this Egyptian hieroglyphic on Sunday, which reminds us that this is an ancient practice indigenous to many cultures worldwide. The diagrams on the right show, from top to bottom, the foreskin covering the gland's penis, the foreskin retracted, and the circumcised penis. As I will describe, circumcision has now been proven to reduce female-to-male transmission of HIV by about 60%. This presentation will cover the biologic plausibility of male circumcision for HIV prevention international data on male circumcision, HIV, and other health outcomes, the relevant epidemiology of HIV and male circumcision in the U.S., critical policy and payment issues, and the process for developing CDC recommendations. The inner mucosal surface of foreskin has been shown to be relatively more susceptible to HIV infection than the outer skin surface of the foreskin, the shaft of the penis, or the glands. The upper micrograph shows the relatively thick outer layer of the fibrous protein keratin on the outer skin surface of the foreskin, which acts as a physical barrier to the virus. In contrast, as shown in the lower micrograph, the inner mucosal surface of the foreskin has a relatively thin layer of keratin. The foreskin may also be susceptible to traumatic epithelial disruption, and the prepital sac may be a conducive microenvironment for viral survival and infection. For those of you who are not familiar with the uncircumcised penis, the schematic above shows the flaccid uncircumcised penis and below the erect uncircumcised penis. The red area is the inner mucosal surface of the foreskin, which is more susceptible to HIV infection, and when the penis becomes erect, becomes highly exposed to the sex partner's body fluids. This slide summarizes studies included in a meta-analysis of male circumcision and HIV infection published in the year 2000. The box and whisker plots show the odds ratios and 95% confidence intervals for 15 observational studies adjusted for other demographic and behavioral variables. For all 15 studies, the adjusted odds ratio was less than 1, meaning that circumcised men were less likely to be HIV infected. The overall adjusted odds ratio was 0.42, meaning that the circumcised men had less than half the odds of being HIV infected as compared to the uncircumcised men. These observational and other studies led to the conduct of 3 randomized controlled clinical trials in Africa. In each study, men were randomly assigned to either immediate circumcision or were waitlisted to delayed circumcision at the conclusion of the study. It is remarkable that all 3 trials were stopped early when interim analyses showed a highly significant reduction in HIV risk in the circumcised men. This table summarizes the main results from the 3 trials, which included more than 11,000 men. The efficacy, that is, the percent reduction in HIV incidence in the men assigned to immediate circumcision as compared to uncircumcised men, ranged from 51% in Uganda to 60% in South Africa. In each study, some men crossed over to the other treatment arm. Some of those assigned to be circumcised were not circumcised, and vice versa. When those discrepancies were accounted for, the calculated efficacy of circumcision ranged from 55% to 76%. Demonstrating a 60% HIV prevention efficacy of a relatively safe, one-time surgical procedure was a landmark accomplishment in the history of HIV prevention research. Aside from HIV infection, male circumcision has been found to be protective against several other adverse health conditions. In this slide from Helen Weiss, you can see that neonatal circumcision has a strong protective effect against urinary tract infection in infants. The female partners of circumcised men have been found to be at less risk for chlamydial infection and cervical cancer. Men who are circumcised have a significantly lower risk of chancroid, penile cancer, and syphilis. Following the publication of the East African clinical trials in February 2007, UNAIDS and the World Health Organization moved quickly to hold a consultation and make recommendations published in March. They concluded that the research evidence was compelling. Male circumcision should be recognized as an efficacious intervention for HIV prevention, an additional strategy for the prevention of heterosexually acquired HIV infection in men. They included a number of other considerations listed here, including a call for additional research, particularly around circumcision safety and efficacy for men who have sex with men and HIV-positive men. Let's now turn our attention to the implications for the United States. I'm presenting 3 slides of the relevant epidemiology of HIV in the U.S. The first two use data from 2005 from the 33 states with confidential name-based HIV reporting. As male circumcision has only been shown to reduce the risk of female-to-male transmission, note that high-risk heterosexual contact, shown in red, was the transmission category for only 15% of men, while 67% were attributed to male-male sexual contact. Overall, high-risk heterosexual contact in men accounted for only 11% of the total cases in both sexes. This slide, which most of you are familiar with, shows rates of HIV/AIDS cases among male adults and adolescents by race and ethnicity. The rates for blacks, 127.6 per 100,000, was nearly seven times higher than for whites, while the rate for Hispanics, 57.6, was more than three times higher. This slide shows the distribution of transmission categories of AIDS cases among men by race and ethnicity from 2001 to 2005. The great majority of cases were among white, black, and Hispanic men. Again, high-risk heterosexual contact is shown in red, and compared to white men, black and Hispanic men had a higher proportion of cases through female-to-male transmission. Now, turning to circumcision, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, NHANES, included self-reported circumcision status and sex behaviors. As reported by Fuji Zhu, of 6,174 men, 79% were circumcised. There were substantial differences by race and ethnicity, with 88% of white men reporting they were circumcised, 73% of black men, and 42% of Mexican-American men. There were no significant differences between circumcised and uncircumcised men in sex behaviors, including reporting male-male sex. This slide shows circumcision rates by birth year and by race and ethnicity in the same NHANES data. Circumcision rates peaked among men born in the 1970s, and differences between blacks and whites decreased. Other data sources also indicate that circumcision rates have declined in recent years, especially in the western United States. There are several key differences between the Africa clinical trial sites and the United States that must be kept in mind when considering the implications of the Africa clinical trials for the United States. First, the prevalence of HIV infection in the clinical trials in the clinical trial countries ranges from 6% to 19%, while the prevalence in the U.S. is 0.4%. Second, the prevalence of male circumcision in the African countries ranges from 10 to 25%, while it is 70 to 80% in the U.S. Thirdly, in the clinical trial countries, most transmission is by heterosexual sex, whereas in the United States, the transmission category for half the cases overall is male-male sex. That is a critical difference. In heterosexual networks, men are always the insertive partner and are partially protected by circumcision. This protection can disrupt the chain of transmission. In contrast, most men who have sex with men engage in both insertive and receptive anal intercourse, and the highest transmission risk is to the receptive partner, where there is little or no plausibility of protection from circumcision. There is less HIV in risk to the insertive partner, where there is some plausible but as yet unproven level of protection from circumcision. With ongoing risk to most men from receptive intercourse, the spread of HIV can be perpetuated in MSM networks, even if there is some reduction in risk for the insertive partner. There is some evidence that male circumcision reduces female-to-male transmission risk in the United States. A prospective study of heterosexual non-IDU in New York City reported in 1993 had an adjusted odds ratio of HIV infection of 0.29 for circumcised men. This was not statistically significant, but it does show a protective trend, and the study was limited with only 14 seroconverters overall. In a more recent retrospective study by Lee Warner, among visits by men with known HIV exposure, circumcision was associated with a significantly reduced HIV prevalence with an adjusted odds ratio of 0.42. Among men who have sex with men, It's a very mixed picture as to whether circumcision reduces HIV infection risk. A cross-sectional study reported in 1993 showed that circumcision cut the odds of infection in half. However, in a study of MSM of color by Greg Millett, published very recently and presented yesterday, circumcision was not protective, even in analysis restricted to men with evidence of recent infection and men who reported only unprotected anal intercourse. Another recently published study of STD clinic clients in San Francisco also showed no protection for male circumcision against HIV infection for MSM. In a study of 63 HIV-infected MSM in Australia, uncircumcised men were no more likely to have been infected by insertive anal intercourse, although one would have expected that to be the case if circumcision afforded some level of protection. Finally, in a study in Peru, there was no protective effect of circumcision overall, but circumcised men who reported mainly insertive anal intercourse did have significantly lower rates of infection than uncircumcised men with the same behavior. Prospective observational studies of circumcision in MSM are also mixed. In a study published in 2005, the odds of HIV infection in circumcised MSM was half that of uncircumcised MSM. But in another study from Australia, there was not significant protection, including among men who reported no receptive anal intercourse. There are many other important factors in considering male circumcision as an HIV prevention intervention. Foremost is safety. Circumcision is a lot simpler and safer in infants than in adults. Pain, bleeding, and infection are the most common complications. Cost is another important factor, with costs about tenfold higher for adult circumcision as compared to infant circumcision. There is also a concern about behavioral risk compensation, that risk behaviors may increase if men believe they are completely protected from HIV infection. Some have also voiced concerns over changes in sexual sensation or function following circumcision. However, in most studies, most men report either improved sexual function or no change. Finally, concerns have been raised over the ethics of parental consent for infant circumcision, an elective preventive procedure, but with most benefits only to be realized in adulthood. Take a little artistic break. This is a detail from one of many paintings through the centuries of the circumcision of Christ. And I include this just to remind ourselves that the procedure is highly imbued with cultural and religious meaning in our society and with potential cultural landmines for any program implementation. The recommendations of the American Academy of Pediatrics are highly influential in infant circumcision practice and have evolved considerably in the past few decades, from saying that there was no absolute medical indication for routine circumcision in 1971, to a more explicit recognition of the benefits in 1989, to an explicit lack of recommendation in 1999. The Academy reaffirmed the 1999 statement in 2005 after the first clinical trial from South Africa was published. However, the Academy has impaneled a new task force on circumcision, which has its inaugural meeting next week, as a major step towards updating its existing policy statement. The language of the AAP recommendation is also important in financing circumcision. In the first study shown here, it was determined that private insurance paid for 61% of infant circumcision, Medicaid paid for 36%, and 3% were self-financed. The second study determined that circumcision was significantly associated with having private insurance, even when controlling for other socio-demographic factors. It must be noted that there are quite active advocates against circumcision. Following the AAP's 1999 statement, they have been successful going from state to state and getting Medicaid to stop payment for circumcision in 16 states as of last year. Let me finish the data presentation with two studies of cost effectiveness in modeling. The first showed that accounting for subsequent savings, including preventing medically necessary adult circumcision, male infant circumcision was actually cost saving, with a net saving of $183 per infant circumcision. The second was presented yesterday by Stephanie Sansom and showed that infant circumcision reduces the lifetime risk of HIV infection in the United States by 14.6%. As an early step to developing recommendations for the United States, the CDC held a consultation on male circumcision, HIV, and other health outcomes in Atlanta this past April. We had a broad spectrum of stakeholders, including the staff of other federal agencies, state and local health departments, professional organizations, academics, community representatives, and religious leaders. Presenters included the primary investigators from the three clinical trials and a widely published anti-circumcision activist. I will present in this and the next three slides what we heard from the consultants. The cross-cutting message was that we needed to communicate to many audiences that the studies demonstrated only partial efficacy and only for female-to-male transmission, that if male circumcision was promoted, it should be part of a broader male reproductive health HIV-STD prevention program, and that any program needed to be culturally competent, recognizing the greater potential benefit for some populations with differing underlying rates of male circumcision and female-to-male HIV transmission risk, but also recognizing the high sensitivity of any perceived targeting of the procedure for minority populations. For high-risk heterosexuals, the consultants felt that efficacy had been demonstrated and that repeating the clinical trials in the U.S. was not warranted, that high-risk heterosexual men should be informed of the benefits along with the risks and the costs, that cost barriers should be reduced, and that we should conduct demonstration projects and operational research on adult male circumcision in the United States to reduce HIV infection risk. In contrast, for men who have sex with men, the consultants felt that there was insufficient data to recommend male circumcision, and the men should be informed that the procedure had not been shown to be protective for HIV transmission during male-male sex. Additional observational data should be collected, and consideration should be given to conducting clinical trials of male circumcision and HIV risk among MSM, depending upon the findings from observational studies. For infants, the consultants felt that the benefits outweigh the risk, that parents should be informed of the benefits, risks, and costs, that cost barriers should be reduced, and that CDC should coordinate efforts with the AAP. Let me close with the planned next steps for developing CDC recommendations. We plan to draft recommendations based on the data, the results of the consultation, and other input. This will be reviewed by an expert panel and by our partners and stakeholders. There will be a public comment period, following which the recommendations will be finalized and disseminated. And let me close by acknowledging my CDC colleagues and the investigators and consultants who assisted me in this presentation. This 1946 painting by Jackson Pollock is titled Circumcision. As we peer into the image to make sense of its emerging figures, with the help of many of you in this room, we aim to make the best sense out of the emerging data for the optimal use of male circumcision to prevent HIV and other adverse health outcomes in the United States. Thank you.
Peter, thank you for that very illuminating presentation, and it's nice to see some modern and not so modern art illuminating HIV prevention in the world. From circumcision, we're going to move to the arena of the use of antiretrovirals for HIV prevention, and it's a pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Myron or Mike Cohen, who is the J. Herbert Bate Distinguished Professor of Medicine, Microbiology, and Immunology, and Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's also the Associate Vice Chancellor for Medical Affairs and Global Health. Dr. Cohen trained in infectious diseases at Yale University. He is a leading expert on the transmission and prevention of transmission of HIV, with a special emphasis on the role played by STD co-infections, and has been a true innovator in the field of finding new ways to understand HIV transmission that potentially would lead us into new ways for prevention. In addition to extensive groundbreaking domestic infectious disease work, Dr. Cohen is an expert on STDs in China and has developed innovative and productive HIV prevention projects in the African nation of Malawi. I'll warn you beforehand, Dr. Cohen has been known to talk quickly in the past, but he's promised to give his one-hour talk in the next 20 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim. Good morning. Well, I must say the other speakers had timed this so perfectly, and there's this big red clock that tells you when you're out of time. So my strategy always is to speed up and slow down, kind of like an airplane going faster and slower. So kind of be prepared for that as we go through this issue. I think this is an important topic, especially for this audience, because antiretroviral therapy is available. It's been the groundbreaking and salutary contribution to the improvement in the lives of people who are HIV infected. And at the same time, we've seen in the last few years the marriage of treatment and prevention. And this marriage, to some extent, focuses on the use of antiviral therapy. So I'm going to, in a very short period of time, summarize everything we think we know about this. And I'm going to use slides. So here's the way that you could use antiviral therapy in this, for these purposes. You could do post-exposure prophylaxis. We're going to abbreviate as PEP. It's called NPEP when it refers to people in non-occupational settings, that is, non-needle stick settings. You could try and prevent HIV infection with pre-exposure prophylaxis, that is, before the exposure. We're going to call that PrEP. And I'm going to warn you, there's a lot of confusion about what PrEP really is, and I'll get into that in a few minutes. The 900-pound gorilla, you could treat the patient who's HIV infected, treat the index case, and expect that the treatment might reduce the probability of secondary transmission to sexual partners. This is really, really important, because in the end of the day, the HIV epidemic is about couples, and we'll come back to that idea. You could use antiviral therapies to allow people, especially in resource-constrained countries, to have children where one partner is infected and the other partner is not infected. And in this case, we're talking about where the man is infected and the woman is not infected. And I'll show you the data that we have that relates to that. And then there's the field of topical microbicides, which has rapidly evolved into the use of antivirals at the mucosal surface. The two drugs that are being pursued most aggressively are tenofovir and a Tibotec drug, TMC-120. I'm not going to talk about that. That's a whole other topic, but I think it's important to realize it's out there regarding antivirals. So first there's the context, and I'm going to show you a couple of slides of context, and the second of these two is really important. All of the prevention efforts we do, most of the prevention that's done worldwide is to prevent people from coming into situations where they're exposed to HIV. But once the exposure occurs, we're all about the biological event, and we call this the transmission event. And you don't get a little bit pregnant, and you don't get a little bit HIV infected. Either you get HIV infected or you don't get HIV infected. We know the transmission event depends on two things. The infectiousness of the person with HIV, that depends on the concentration of HIV in the genital secretions. It also depends on the kind of virus they have. The clades or the types of viruses are different in different parts of the world. In the United States, we have type B. In other countries, in Africa in particular, there's a lot of type C. Then there's susceptibility. Not everyone is equally susceptible to HIV, and there are different levels of resistance. This slide is really important because this is about what we have to do. So what you see on the axis is the concentration of HIV you might encounter. And you see that when there's an exposure event, that if HIV transmission occurs, that if a virus finds its way across the mucosa, there's a transit time of a small number of days. And so now a transmission event has already occurred. And then there's what's called a ramp-up viremia. And what we'd like to do with antivirals, first of all, is prevent transit. So if pre-exposure prophylaxis really worked, or a microbicide really worked, there would never be a transit event. Then you see when there's the transit event going on, it's below the detection of our measurement. Then there's the ramp-up viremia, and then there's a dashed line that shows that now suddenly we can detect HIV. It's that window of opportunity to prevent HIV that we're very concerned about for antivirals as prevention, and for vaccines as prevention. So that one green window of opportunity is where all the action is in our arena. So the questions about ART for prevention are, does it work? Is it safe for the individual and the community? And here, the word community is a real special word. It's not just the people who are using ART. For example, if you're dealing with an ART prevention trial in sex workers, and you say the sex workers are the community, what about their clients? What if the prevention trial on the sex workers creates an environment where the clients become infected with resistant viruses, or resistant viruses envelop the entire community? So the word community here is really important. And then the question is there anything... I talk fast, so I have to drink something during the... Then the question is, does this inspire sexual disinhibition or risk compensation? If we tell people that there are drugs out there that are going to make it safer to have unprotected intercourse, what happens with the number of episodes of intercourse they have? Can you all understand me at this rate of speed? Is this then I'm going to talk faster. This is... Okay, so there are now we're going to go to monkeys, and the CDC has made a terrific contribution in the animal group that works at the group of investigators who work with animals. They are animals, but the group of investigators who work with macaques at the CDC deserve real terrific recognition for their work in prevention. So first we're going to talk about post-exposure prophylaxis. There are a series of studies done with exposure of animals to HIV. And when the animals are exposed, drugs are given to the animals, and then the question is, are the animals protected from getting HIV? And as summarized in this slide, there are some principles we gain from work with animals, particularly done at the CDC, that says the following. If you expose an animal to HIV and you use antivirals properly, as quickly as you can, but especially within 72 hours, and you give the antivirals for 28 days, you can protect the animals from getting HIV infection. This has led to the following conclusions. First of all, we cannot do a clinical trial to prove that post-exposure prophylaxis works. It's just not possible for a variety of technical reasons. So because of this, in 2005, the CDC had an expert panel that generated guidelines that I firmly believe in, and these CDC guidelines are for post-exposure prophylaxis are summarized in this slide, published sort of looking like this in MMWR. When you see somebody you think has been exposed to HIV, you first decide, is it negligible risk or is it significant exposure? If there's never been exposure, there's no reason to think about post-exposure prophylaxis. Second, you look at the time. If more than 72 hours have gone by, it's unlikely that the person will get benefit from the drugs. But if less than 72 hours have gone by, it becomes a real emergency in which you give the appropriate antiviral therapy. Now let me say just one word about the 72 hours. You don't want to wait 72 hours. If you're in a rape situation, you would say, this is now my opinion, you would say, this is an emergency. Take these pills right now, and if we decide 2 or 3 days from now they're not appropriate for you, that decision can be made. But time is really critical. And one of the big problems of post-exposure prophylaxis is delay of starting of therapy. It's not something to think about, it's something to do. So you take the pills for emergently, and then you must take them for 28 days, because the animal data suggests that less than 28 days allows some animals to get HIV. And the other thing is which pills. In my opinion, it depends on the community you're living in and how much resistance there is. But generally speaking, you're going to give post-exposure prophylaxis with a triple drug combination. And this slide shows the concentration of drugs in the female genital tract, which my colleague Angela Kashuba and I have worked on for some period of time. What it shows is that some drugs concentrate in the genital tract and some drugs don't get in the genital tract. On the left, you see that the protease inhibitor class of drugs has trouble getting into the genital tract. You see on the right the drugs like 3TC and tenofovir, they concentrate in the genital tract. So for sure, as you're giving post-exposure prophylaxis, you want to give drugs that are appropriate to your community, you want to give them emergently, and you want to give drugs that you know will get into the genital tract quickly and in high concentration. So that's our story with post-exposure prophylaxis. Now let's go to lessons from monkeys 2, pre-exposure prophylaxis. Now the reason I have that in quotes is because real pre-exposure prophylaxis would be giving a drug one or two times and stopping. But the way that we define tests of pre-exposure prophylaxis, both in monkeys and in clinical trials, is to give daily pre-exposure prophylaxis. Well, it's not really pre-exposure prophylaxis, it's treatment. And I think that's something we're going to have to deal with as we develop this whole field. So the reason that the PrEP field came about was because the pharmaceutical companies have been both generous and creative, and they developed drugs like tenofovir and then the combination tenofovir and FTC that have a very long half-life, that have high resistance barriers to mutation, and can be taken very safely. So that leads us first to the monkey experiments. This is a really important slide, so now I'm going to slow down. This is coming out in PLOS Medicine in the next few weeks. It's by the CDC group led by Garcia Lerma. And what it shows is when you give rectal exposure of HIV to monkeys, that's the dashed line where at the very bottom, all the monkeys get infected over 14 weeks. When you use the drug tenofovir alone, orally, for these animals, increase the amount of time required for them to get infected. So you see the green line with oral TDF, that's oral tenofovir, most of the monkeys become infected, but it takes them longer to become infected. But what you see is when you use combo PrEP, tenofovir plus FTC, that's oral Truvada, 4 out of 6 monkeys remained uninfected over 14 weeks. And when you give injectable Truvada, none of the monkeys became infected. The problem with injectable Truvada is it achieves concentrations that are toxic, much higher than a human would get. The bottom line is these small number of monkeys give us biological plausibility to believe that if we give these pills to humans, we can prevent them from getting HIV infection. Now, that prevention might occur in two ways. It might occur in the real pre-exposure prophylaxis. They're exposed, and the drug is there, and there's no transmission event. Or this might be acting as treatment. During that window of opportunity I showed you, it might be killing the virus enough so that transmission doesn't occur. So there's one trial completed that show limited toxicity of tenofovir, and then there are several trials ongoing, mostly led by the CDC. And summarized on this slide are the ongoing trials showing in different parts of the world either tenofovir or Truvada being used to test whether PrEP works. I would emphasize this is daily dosing of these drugs, not real 2 doses of PrEP. There are trials planned, and these are the trials planned, one by the Gates Foundation in discordant couples, and then one comparing topical microbicides to Truvada or tenofovir, that's by the Microbicide Trials Network, and there's a USAID trial planned as well. So we have a lot of activity using daily oral tenofovir or oral Truvada to try and prevent HIV acquisition in risk populations. There have been problems with these trials that there have been ethical concerns about them. There's been concerns about resistance, viral resistance developing when you use tenofovir alone. And there's been a concern about how relevant is this to public health. Can this really change the epidemic? Now we're going to move finally to what is really the most important topic. If you give an infected person antiviral therapy, do you slow or do you reduce the probability they'll infect somebody else? Well, first of all, there's the biological plausibility. We know that suppression can occur when we give people HIV therapy, and the suppression is excellent, but really incomplete. We have some expectations from the literature, and we have a clinical trial. This is how transmission looks. These are real numbers. On the left, you have the concentration of HIV in semen, and then you have the numbers are the transmission probability at different stages of disease. You see that when somebody first gets HIV, acute infection, they don't know they're infected, they have a high probability of infecting somebody else. The dashed line and the red are what would happen if we could put people on therapy and lower their viral load so they could not infect the next person. That's what we'd be trying to do with therapy. So we have retrospective studies that suggest that when you put somebody on therapy, you reduce the transmission probability. We've got 2 observational studies I'll mention quickly. And we've got ecological studies that say when you treat a population with ART heavily, you see less HIV. In Taiwan, they screened the entire island, tried to find all the HIV-infected people, put all the HIV-infected people on free therapy, and seemed to demonstrate a drastic reduction in the number of expected cases of HIV. That's the study by Fang in 2004. 2 observational studies. One from Rwanda, in which ART was offered since 2003. There were 1,034 serodiscordant couples discovered. There were 248 people who deserved ART because of low CD4 count. In this study, 42 seroconversions occurred, but only 2 out of 42 occurred when the person was taking antiviral therapy. So 40 out of 42 seroconversions occurred in people when the index case was not taking antiviral therapy. This observational study led the authors to conclude that they saw an 80% reduction from treating the person with antiviral therapy. Becky Bunnell from the CDC has worked extensively in Uganda on the same problem. She's done a study that she's published in AIDS of 454 subjects where they identified subjects who deserved therapy based on low CD4 count and high HIV copy number. They observed that the amount of sex increased in the couple, but over the 2 years of the study, they only saw one seroconversion event, whereas they anticipated many seroconversion events. Becky has told me that subsequently she's continued to follow this population, and again, she sees a benefit to the antiviral therapy, appearing to suppress transmission events. But of course, there are problems with observational studies. You can't control which couples go in the study, the dropout rates, etc. You can't control for behavior changes. Observational and retrospective studies are only focusing on people with low CD4 count, but the epidemic really involves couples with CD4 counts all over the place. So a clinical trial is necessary. So this is a gigantic clinical trial. This is called HBTN-052 CHAVI-007 ACTG-5245. This is a study to compare immediate antiviral therapy at high CD4 count versus delayed antiviral therapy as CD4 count falls. The study can do two things. It can look at transmission. These are couples. So the end point is the partner. So you start the person who's infected with high CD4 count on antiviral therapy, and you look to see whether the antiviral therapy stops the transmission to the partner. You also can determine whether early antiviral therapy benefits the person who's taking early antiviral therapy. This is a study to be done, or is being done in now 9 countries, and it's 1,750 serodiscordant couples to be followed for 5 years with 90% power to detect a 35% reduction in sexual transmission of HIV. This study is enormously expensive. The drugs alone cost $21 million. I won't tell you how much the study costs to do. What's interesting is these are the first data from the study that have not been published, and they show you that when you look at the high CD4 count index patients, you might say their CD4 counts are so high, they have no virus. They'll never transmit HIV. In fact, what you find is they have almost 5 logs of virus in their blood, and that's enough HIV to represent a real danger for transmission events. So this study is very likely to be successful unless it's stopped for equipoise reasons or other reasons. But there are limitations of this idea. So now I've given you the idea that when you treat your patient, maybe you're going to stop them from transmitting HIV. But could we ever treat enough people on this planet to slow down the epidemic? What about the cost and the limits of acquisition of ART? And what about resistance? Resistance has to occur when we treat a person. And as resistance occurs, the person can transmit their resistant virus to the next person. And we know that among the new cases of HIV all over the world, a substantial number show resistance to antivirals, even though they never received an antiviral, showing us that transmitted resistance is a real problem. And then there's the question of the public health impact. Can we ever treat enough people? I've already said that. Can we treat the subjects who are most infectious? And what about breakthrough viremia? Well, this is this slide again. I want to emphasize the left-hand side. People who have acute HIV infection have about 5 logs of HIV in their semen. They don't know they're infected. They're likely to infect the next person. So we see clusters of infection. But we can't find these people to treat these people. So even if treatment is used to prevent HIV for index cases, we'll probably never find the people who are most contagious. We'll find only the group with established infection who have a lower probability anyhow of infecting the next person. Then there's breakthrough viremia. So do people with HIV infection continue to have sex? Of course they do. Do some of those people get STDs? Of course they do. And what's shown on this slide is that we know even if we suppress people with antiviral therapy, STDs help people break through the suppression. So you see these little blips where we can recover more HIV in semen, even in people who have been suppressed on antiviral therapy. Okay, the last thing I want to mention is the use of antivirals to prevent, to allow pregnancy to occur. Pietro Vernazza, one of my fellows from many years ago, presented a paper with 21 serodiscordant couples who were trying to get pregnant. The male partners were suppressed completely with antiviral therapy. The female partners were offered tenofovir 36 hours before and 12 hours before unprotected intercourse. 15 of 21 pregnancies occurred within 10 cycles. 50% occurred in 3 cycles. None of the women became infected. But this doesn't prove the stuff works because infection would not be expected to occur in so few subjects. But the point is that this is a real-world problem. People in Africa with HIV infection and discordant partnerships, they want to have children. So I think Pietro's work is going to help us lead towards a policy. So now I've talked very fast. I've tried to summarize this entire field. Most of this is in an article published in the Annals of Internal Medicine earlier this year. I wanted to conclude as follows. Post-exposure prophylaxis is really important. It will be used, but we will not be able to prove its benefits. Pre-exposure prophylaxis, in quotations, will determine whether daily treatment works. We're going to know that within 2 years. But then we're going to need to go back and do real trials of briefer courses of therapy, of 1 or 2 days of pre-exposure prophylaxis. Antiviral suppression is going to be part of our HIV prevention strategy, and we have no option but to study people who are on therapy to determine what happens to the probability they will transmit to their sexual partners. And this is where we stand in 2008 with antivirals for prevention. Thank you.
Mike, thank you very much, and thank you for talking at a pace I think we could all understand and staying within time. Well, from antiretrovirals, we're going to go to the arena of HIV testing, one of the cornerstones of our HIV prevention strategy. And Dr. Bernie Branson, who is the Associate Director for Laboratory Diagnostics in our Division of HIV-AIDS Prevention at CDC, will give us this talk. Dr. Branson is a leading expert in the field of HIV testing technologies and HIV prevention strategies. Dr. Branson trained in internal medicine and pediatrics at UNC Chapel Hill, and he was on the clinical faculty at Johns Hopkins University, and he has been a real doctor in clinical practice in Baltimore, and was doing both academic and clinical work before he came to CDC in 1990, and Bernie's playing a key role in CDC strategies to roll out HIV testing as a prevention strategy. So, Bernie, take it away.
Thank you, Tim, and thanks to the conference organizers for letting me speak a little bit about HIV testing and prevention. And like Mike Cohen just said, one of the issues about testing, of course, is that it is available already for us. And with respect to questions of HIV testing and prevention, it's not a new one. This is a brochure from a conference that CDC held in 1987 on the role of testing and HIV prevention in the control of AIDS, when a lot of the precepts were established related to HIV testing. And at that time, I think that the state of the art for HIV testing was using the ELISA and the Western blot, and in many places that still is the state of the art. And I want to mention some other things that were state of the art in 1987, which was the year that Compaq introduced the 26-pound portable computer, and all telephones still had wires connected to them. And a lot of the precepts that we established and used for HIV testing and prevention still date back to that same time, really until the recommendations we came out with last year. I want to talk a little bit about the current status of HIV testing in the U.S., some of the evidence related to behavior and the awareness of HIV infection, early experiences with expanded testing since last year's recommendations, and some of the challenges that still faced us. A big example of testing and prevention for us comes from the recommendations for testing and prophylaxis for pregnant women, when CDC since 1995 recommended routine voluntary testing for pregnant women as part of prenatal care with simplified pretest counseling and flexible consent process. And this really represents one of the major accomplishments. We really solved HIV transmission in this country in two places, transfusion-associated transmission and perinatal transmission, where since the implementation of widespread screening recommendations and effective prophylaxis since 1995, the number of cases has gone down 95% of perinatally acquired AIDS in this country. It's one of our prevention successes. Now, looking at HIV testing, a lot of people at this conference in this room mostly think about CDC-funded testing or testing in publicly funded sites. And we are still doing about 2 million tests a year funded by CDC money. But what you see here is that the number of people we identify as positive has really been going down from about 4.6% early in the epidemic down to about 1.2% as of 2004. And for those of you who went to the presentation yesterday from New York, we saw that of the people tested at these sites, half or more are duplicate testers. They've known them and infected. And so we're potentially identifying fewer people in our publicly funded testing. Looking at the National Health Interview Survey, a nationally representative household-based sample that asks people, have you been tested for HIV? These are the rates of what people report. So that in the top line there, which represents minority females, nearly 50% say they've been tested for HIV at least once in their lifetime. And the rate among white females is also high, approximately the same as among minority males, but overall between 35 and 50% of people in the United States say they've been tested for HIV at least once in their life. Looking at high-risk people, we have CDC's what are called HIV testing surveys that have been conducted periodically since 1995. And again, among high-risk individuals, we see very high rates of HIV testing. So that among STD clinic patients, most of them high-risk heterosexuals, between 70 and 75% have been tested. And among injection drug users and men who have sex with men, the rates are 88 to 90% of people have been HIV tested. So our targeted testing strategy has really reached a lot of the people that we wanted to reach, but our activities in publicly funded testing are identifying fewer and fewer HIV-positive patients. Asking people where they got tested, I think, gives us some information. CDC does or funds about 2 million tests a year. That represents somewhere between 10 and 15% of the 16 to 22 million persons who are tested annually in the United States. And so the issue is that most HIV testing that goes on in this country goes on in healthcare settings. So that 44% of people represent they got tested by their doctor or their HMO. Another quarter of people say they were tested in the hospital emergency department or emergency department. And only around 10% of people said they got tested in a counseling and testing site or STD clinic or correctional facility or drug treatment clinic where we're funding testing. And in the right-hand column from the Supplement to HIV-AIDS Surveillance, similarly, about two-thirds of people who are diagnosed HIV positive are diagnosed in private healthcare settings by their doctor, their hospital, emergency department. And our publicly funded testing still accounts for only about a quarter to a third of the HIV-positive people who are identified. So when we think about testing, and certainly when CDC thought about its recommendations, a big part of the consideration was to follow where people are already receiving their services. The problem with this testing in healthcare settings is that people get tested late. Looking at this analysis from the Supplement to HIV-AIDS Surveillance between 2000 and 2003, about 45% of people were first diagnosed HIV positive within 12 months of receiving their AIDS diagnosis. So basically, they had been infected and infectious on average for 10 years before they ever got tested. And the late testers, compared to those who tested early, that is more than 5 years before their AIDS diagnosis, tended to be younger and heterosexual and less educated and African American or Hispanic. And the problem is that our surveillance data indicates that persistently nearly half, 39, 40% of persons with AIDS reported to the CDC are still tested late, first tested within a year of their diagnosis. And the reason for this is they get tested because they're sick. In the red bars, you see the late testers, nearly two-thirds of them got their HIV test because they were symptomatic with an HIV-associated condition. And what we're seeking to do, as represented by the blue bars, is to shift this over so that more people are tested as part of routine checkups when there's still an opportunity to make some difference with intervention and to use some of the antiretrovirals that Mike Cohen has just talked about with us. I want to give an example. Right after our recommendations came out, North South Carolina published an analysis. They have a system there so that their health care visits are all reported to the Office of Research Statistics, the number of visits and the diagnoses of them. And they were able, through careful confidential matching, to look at all the reported cases of HIV from 2001 to 2005 and the health care visits those people had made around and prior to the time of their diagnosis. And looking at just those patients who developed AIDS within a year of their diagnosis, they found that 73% of these people had made 8,000 healthcare visits. That's an average of 4 per person, but never got tested for HIV. So these were people who were in relatively advanced stages of HIV disease, and looking at their visits, nearly 80% of them were made to emergency departments, and nearly 80% of the diagnosis codes for those healthcare visits would not have suggested the need for an HIV test. So this led to our indication that continuing to follow our strategy of looking for risk factors and looking for healthcare conditions was going to result in a large number of missed opportunities for HIV testing. So our rationale for revising the recommendations for testing in healthcare settings was, as I've shown you, many people are accessing healthcare, but they're not treated for HIV until they're symptomatic. And because effective treatment is available, this is unacceptable. In addition, the awareness of HIV infection leads to substantial reductions in high-risk sexual behavior. So that the primary indication for starting to do screening is shown on this slide, which is that treatment works. In the yellow line, you see the proportion of patients on highly active antiretroviral therapy. The pink line shows the number of deaths per 100 person years. And we see that in the mid-1990s, with the availability of protease inhibitors and triple therapy, those lines crossed and they continue to diverge, so that treatment makes a difference for individuals. And this is the first and foremost reason for doing more HIV screening. But there are other public health consideration with respect to testing and prevention does have to do with behavior after people test positive for HIV. And the first study that for me sort of sorted out the issue about is it counseling or is it testing comes from this study that Grant Colfax did among men in the HIV, in the HIVnet cohort, where people received counseling and testing at entry to the study and every 6 months subsequently. And what you see in the first column are the people and their sexual behavior at the visit when it was discovered that they had seroconverted. And so despite multiple episodes of HIV counseling and testing, nearly half of the participants were still practicing receptive, unprotected anal intercourse. And when they found out that they were HIV infected without any further intervention, that proportion dropped substantially and remained down substantially 12 months afterwards in their follow-up every 3 months. And I think this started to help sort out the fact that people finding out they were HIV infected really did change their behavior. Looking at people in the supplement to HIV/AIDS surveillance, we got some idea of what they did in terms of changing their behavior. So that a proportion of people, about a quarter, were completely abstinent after they found out they were infected. And these were people who knew for 12 months or more about their HIV infection. Some people, about 15%, had sex with a single HIV-positive partner only. And all of our studies show that this is a choice that many HIV-infected persons make, which is to have sex only with other HIV-infected persons. Some people were sexually active without vaginal or anal intercourse. About 40% of people had only protected intercourse. And the key issue is that only 14% of infected individuals were continuing to practice sexual behaviors that risk the transmission of HIV. So Gary Marks at CDC did a meta-analysis of all the studies looking at what happens when people know they're HIV-infected. And he showed that after people become aware that they're HIV positive, their prevalence of high-risk sexual behavior with uninfected partners is 68% lower than HIV-infected people who don't know they're infected. And as we've talked about this figure in different circumstances, people say, well, it doesn't apply to my population. So looking at the specific studies that were involved in this, what I wanted to go through is not only the proportion of reduction in prevalence of high-risk sexual behavior, but that it's across the board, so that a lot of these studies were done in men who have sex with men, and a proportion of them were done in heterosexual men, and the finding was consistent among women, and it was also seen among injection drug users. And so this is not just a phenomenon limited to a small group of people, but it's pretty much across the board for everyone who is susceptible and everyone who becomes infected with HIV. And that is a session that will be presented today at 10:30, on the Brothers y Hermanos study of people who are aware and unaware they're HIV infected. What they also showed is that this risk reduction persisted despite drug use, so that uses of coke and crack and meth and heroin and ecstasy still showed a 45% relative reduction in their risk compared to 51% reduction among people who were not drug users. And importantly, in this study, they analyzed people on the basis of how long they knew they were HIV infected. And what they showed is that the prevalence of unprotected sex did not differ significantly by the length of time that people knew they were infected. So it wasn't something that happened just when you found out and petered out afterwards, but there were long-term differences in sexual behavior, which led to this slide I think that everybody is pretty familiar with. The quarter of the people who don't know that they're infected account for anywhere between 54 and 70% of new infections. So if the people who didn't know they were infected went down, the number of new infections would clearly diminish on the basis of evidence we already have. So I wanted to talk a little bit about CDC's revised recommendations and the experiences from the field with respect to their implementation. And as I think most of you are familiar, we're now calling for routine voluntary screening for all persons when they encounter healthcare settings. That separate signed informed consent has been a barrier and should no longer be required. And so we're asking for opt-out HIV screening where people have voluntary testing with the opportunity to ask questions and the option to decline testing. And the first evidence of the effect of informed consent came from San Francisco, where they had a regulation that you had to have signed informed consent when an individual got an HIV test, and they had to go to the lab with the requisition, and if a consent didn't accompany the requisition, the specimen was rejected. When our first draft of recommendations came out, San Francisco changed this regulation. Separate signed informed consent wasn't required anymore. HIV was on the regular lab requisition, and they compared their rates of testing and diagnoses before and after that change. So that in San Francisco, testing had already been on a slow increase between 2004 and 2005, but after the change in the informed consent requirement, there was an abrupt increase in testing. And they had identified about 21 HIV positive tests per month when the requirement for signed informed consent was in place, and that increased to 31 HIV positive tests per month after that requirement was changed. So this was the first ecologic evidence that, in fact, the signed informed consent was a barrier for individuals to getting tested and to identifying people who are HIV positive. And since that time, and I'm in the government, I'm used to government moving at geologic paces, we've seen 8 states that have already changed their requirements for written consent, and this has been very much a product of collaboration between providers and community organizations, and there's going to be a roundtable on this today at 5:30 among a lot of the people in community groups who were part of the processes in changing requirements both for written consent and people working on issues related to opt-out perinatal testing. Another example for expanded screening comes from Fort Worth, Texas, in the JPS Health System. I've always sort of enjoyed this fancy picture of what their health services are like. They started doing point-of-care testing in their emergency department back at the end of fiscal year 2005, at first just for victims of sexual assault. And their testing went from 460 tests per year in the emergency department in 2005 to nearly 16,000 tests in the first 9 months of this fiscal year in that institution. And when we look at the number of HIV-infected people who were identified, it went up from 600 to 900 and in the first 9 months of this year to 900, well on the course to doubling the number of HIV-infected people identified in their outpatient department. And what they're doing is just testing people who get point-of-care testing done for other reasons. And so they looked at the diagnoses of the people who turned out to be HIV infected, and the number one diagnosis was chest pain, and number two was bronchitis, and number three was abdominal pain. At that institution, HIV testing is now part of the standing orders for anybody who comes in with chest pain. And this isn't because people with HIV infection are having chest pain or bronchitis or abdominal pain more often. It's because the people who come to the EDs for these conditions are the people who turn out to be HIV infected but don't know it. In New York, the Health and Hospitals Corporation, the largest municipal hospital system in the United States, they set a goal to increase their HIV testing. And I want to point out that this was done in a state with a circumstance where they have a required state-sponsored signed two-part consent form. And as they set out to increase their HIV testing, it went up from about 50,000 tests a year up until fiscal year 05 to 92,000 in fiscal year 06 to 133,000 fiscal year 07. And they more than doubled the number of HIV positive people they identified coming through their health system simply by expanding this routine screening. Another important consideration is from this study at GW University. They started their testing program when CDC's recommendations came out, and as has been shown in many of the routine screening programs, about 60% of people accepted their testing. In their first 3 months or so, they identified 41 or 1% of the people as being HIV positive. But importantly, what we've been encouraging these programs to do is ask the patients what they think of this whole idea. You know, as providers, we have a lot of feelings. Community advocates similarly have some considerations about whether people favor this approach to HIV testing. So in this facility, as well as several others where we've been encouraging testing, they interviewed the people who accepted testing and the people who declined testing. They asked them what they thought about coming through and getting tested in these circumstances. And one of their questions was, is the ER a good place to perform HIV testing? And what you see from this preliminary data is that only 8% of people said, well, I don't think it's such a good idea. Overall, 75% of people agreed or strongly agreed. Some people didn't have any opinion. And when they asked them, you know, would you recommend it to a friend to get an HIV test when they came through this environment, 85% of the people said, yeah, I think that makes sense. I think that it's a good idea. And so for us, I think this is some evidence not only that our sense of the recommendations make sense to people, but the patients think it's probably a pretty good idea as well. We've still got some continuing challenges as we move forward with these recommendations, and I think that one of the biggest for me has to do with two of the recommendations that haven't received a lot of attention so far. One is repeat HIV screening for all persons who are likely to be at high risk, at least annually. And the second one was that healthcare providers should encourage their patients and their prospective sex partners to be tested before initiating a new sexual relationship. And we may focus a little more attention on these recommendations in the future. But these data that Kevin Fenton mentioned in the opening session related to testing among men who have sex with men, I think have some indication about the issues we still face with respect to this repeat testing. Because of people interviewed in CDC's National HIV Behavioral Surveillance, men who have sex with men in these five cities, 25% of them were infected with HIV. That figure was 46% among black MSM. And unfortunately, half, 48% of the people who were infected were unaware of that. That figure was 67% among black men who have sex with men. And it was nearly 80% among the most sexually active age group, the 18 to 24-year-old men who have sex with men. So we clearly have some work yet to do with respect to accomplishing the testing among persons who are at high risk. I think the other issue we're going to face increasingly is what do we say to all the people who test negative? In most of the places we're doing this testing, 99% or more of people will test negative. With respect to primary prevention strategies, we know what works, but many of these facilities don't have the time to initiate the strategies that we know to be effective, and we're going to have to establish coordination and collaboration with community-based organizations. A term that I personally particularly dislike is serosorting. We know that it happens, and the question is whether it can be effective for prevention. The idea of people just using serosorting on the basis of casual partners they encounter so far looks like it's not very effective. And I do want to focus on the concept of negotiated safety, which has to do with what happens when people establish relationships. And I think this brings us back around to the first presentation with respect to the use of the internet and the establishment of relationships for not only, or prevention strategies, not only for individuals, but for larger groups of people. And negotiated safety depends on the certainty that both partners are HIV negative, an explicit agreement about sex and sex outside the relationship, which is the nature of that safety agreement, and then obviously honesty and trust between those individuals. And we have to pay attention to it, because if you look at the internet, You can Google the idea of no condoms and get all kinds of advice about what you should do about stop using condoms when you find out you're HIV negative. And I think that's the next challenge for us, is to figure out not only how to find more HIV positive people, but to help HIV negative people understand better how to continue their protection for themselves. I'd like to thank you very much for your attention and acknowledge a lot of the people who presented the unpublished data for us, including those from New York and Fort Worth and GW University Hospital, and thank you for your attention.
Well, Bernie, thank you very much, and I hope you're all as energized as I am about these presentations. Clearly, we have HIV testing now. The internet is out there now, and we're learning how that can be used for HIV prevention and interventions. Circumcision exists, and we're trying to learn how that applies to the U.S. context. And within a couple of years, we're going to understand better how antiretroviral therapy fits into HIV prevention. So I hope this morning session has got you going. There's a lot going on the rest of the day. Just one reminder, the plenary sessions tomorrow morning start at 10 o'clock, and they lead into the closing session, which is 11:30 to 12. So thank you all. Let's have a round of applause for our four presentations. And I think our conference coordinator, Bob Komischer, probably has some words of wisdom for us. Bob?
Great, thank you. If Dr. Cohen was able to deliver his one-hour presentation in 20 minutes, I think Dr. Branson delivered a two-hour presentation in 20 minutes. And I say that because there is so much information that's being presented at this conference. You need to be aware that Kaiser Family Foundation is making the plenary sessions available on webcast, and we'll be providing you information on that via email after the conference. Also, all of the presentations that you're visiting and attending during these 3.5 days will also be on the internet. Our National Prevention Information Network, NPIN, will be providing copies of the presentations on their website, and we'll make that available to you also. A couple of other announcements. The updated compendium and tiers of evidence for HIV behavioral interventions is scheduled for 10:30 this morning in the spring room. Also, I want to point out that session CO4, HIV testing in clinical settings, was previously scheduled for tomorrow morning. It's going to actually occur this morning at, going to occur this afternoon at 1:30 p.m. in the spring room. And today we have a number of special listening sessions scheduled. Dr. Fenton and Dr. Jansen will be meeting with the African-American community at 12:15. All of these meetings are scheduled in the International Ballroom South. He'll be meeting with Latino and Latinas at 5:15 p.m. this afternoon, and Native Americans at 6:30 p.m. And finally, I also want to remind you, poster set up for Tuesday. Please have your poster set up by 11 o'clock this morning. Another session that is not listed up here is PEMS. We have a special affinity session scheduled for that from 5 to 6 p.m. in the Dunwoody Room, so you might want to make a note of that. Again, PEMS affinity session is scheduled for 5 p.m. this afternoon in the Dunwoody Room. And then this evening, for your, we have a number of events scheduled. Among those many events, the play Divine Interventions. This is a play that addresses the impact of HIV infection on African-American women, so you want to be sure to make that in the Regency Ballroom 7. And then finally, the video, Just As We Are, is going to be presented at 6:30 p.m. in the Inman Room. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful conference.